And again, he talks about good intentions and that God has good intentions. And so this next section then in the chapter has to do with compatibilism and moral responsibility. Right? He says biblical compatibilism, that is the compatibility of divine and human choosing, what God chooses, what we choose, helps us, he tells us, to sort out where moral responsibility lies. While God authors the plot, as it were, in which evil takes place for his good purposes, it is only secondary agents who bear the moral culpability, right, the blameworthiness for the evil that God decrees. Mm-hmm. So God does not act on behalf of the choosing agent. The agent himself or herself deliberately, willingly, voluntarily acts without any divine coercion.
Right.
God isn't forcing it. It's coming out of the evil desires of the right. person's heart.
This is the puppeteer. He's not puppeteering. He's not entering into this person, making them robotically move to his will.
They're doing it out of their own heart's desires, right? So God can never, he says, be the efficient cause of evil. It's not the transcendent God who sins, right? God isn't sinning when I do something. It's the creaturely agent who intends evil and then acts on those evil intentions, right?
So I think one of the biggest and best illustrations of this is in Genesis with the story of Joseph. And we saw this as a big factor in his other book, What About Free Will? And he says, for instance, in the story of Joseph, there is a dual explanation for Joseph's being sold into slavery. His brothers did the deed. They sold his brother into captivity. Mm-hmm. But God stood behind their action. In fact, it says that God restrained them from killing him. They wanted to kill him, but then brother comes along and says, no, let's not do that. That would be bad. I know, let's just sell him into slavery away from us, and then let's lie to our father that he was dead.
Yeah.
way better. His brothers did the deed, but God stood behind their actions. God is the primary agent, while they are secondary agents. Both intended the evil to take place, but they have different culpabilities, responsibilities there. The difference lies in the internal desires that birth their intentions. For Joseph's brothers, their actions were born of a hateful motive. They meant evil. What you intended for evil for God, though, the evil could be born of nothing other than a good motive, because that's who he is. He's transcendent, his characteristic. He doesn't have a sin nature, and so he only has, by that logic, a good motive to deliver his chosen people from certain doom. What they intended for evil, God meant it for good.
Right. So again, this issue of intention is doing a lot of work for him here, right? The fact that we intend to do evil, to disobey God, and to act contrary to what he wants, that's makes us morally responsible for what we do, right? Because what we do is coming out of our evil intentions. God, on the other hand, when he decrees an evil action, isn't first morally responsible for it because the creatures do it, but second, he isn't evil because he has good intentions, right? He doesn't have an evil heart. He doesn't have evil motives, right? So that's where he's getting at, what he's getting at.
Mm-hmm. Right? So this has a tremendous practical importance. It causes us to realize that evil does not occur independently. It has no power of its own. No evil, no demon, no satanically inspired scheme can surprise God escaping his notice. Mm-hmm. Again, it's not God and Satan having an arm wrestling match over the earth. It's the devil is God's devil. We're God's evil creation that he redeems. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, no evil scheme exists outside of his all-powerful hand or his all-wise and all-good purposes. And finally, the perpetrator of sin can never say, God made me do this, as though he were being forced against his will. God effectively ensures his sin, but God emphatically did not sin his sin, no more than Shakespeare sins of the sins of Macbeth. The only sin that exists is that which exists in the heart of the willful perpetrator.
Right, exactly. So God doesn't do the sin, right? The individual does the sin, and so the individual is culpable, is the one to be blamed, right? Mm-hmm. So now we have what he's struggling with here, or not struggling, but what he's trying to help us see here is the compatibility here,
right.
The compatibilist position, where our free will can be compatible with God's decrees and God's, you know, carrying out what he wants to accomplish, right? Mm-hmm. And so he says there's no conflict then between human choosing and divine choosing, between human freedom and divine freedom. There's no conflict between primary and secondary causation, between the plot that the divine author writes and the actors who willingly carry it out. Furthermore, he says God is free to sovereignly will that which his moral will has commanded us not to do.
Right.
Right? Therefore, when his creatures willingly transgress his clear moral will written on their hearts, Romans chapter 2, in service of his secret and sovereign will, they will bear the demands of his irreproachable justice. In the end, he tells us, reconciling God's meticulous sovereignty with the matrix of divine and human freedom, and particularly moral responsibility, is not the insurmountable task that so many detractors have suggested.
Right. Right. So he's using a means to get to the ends. He declares the means as well as the ends. And so I was trying to think of an analogy for this. And so I said, God uses sinful men to accomplish his purpose. That's the desire. And so this is like a king utilizing his troops to go to war. But you know who he wouldn't use? He wouldn't use the maidens, the noblemen, the farmers. He would use the military. And so God is accomplishing his goals with the appropriate troops, sinful men.
All right.
So he's able to do that. He's not sinning. He's not the person that's carrying out the war. He's decreeing that it will happen by these people. So, again, all analogies break down, but that's how I kind of envisioned it.